Support for today's episode comes from Maple Leaf Foods. We all have questions about the food we cook. Is it natural? Is it good for my family? What about the planet? Maple Leaf's answer is in the foods they're proud to provide, with natural ingredients for Canadian families.
He's really camouflaged. Like, see the pattern?
Last time on Home Cooked, we met Corey Snake.
I got him.
Oh my God, you got him.
I got him.
Good size, eh?
He took us spearfishing at night and introduced us to a 5,000-year-old fish weir site that not many Canadians have ever heard of. It's right here in Ontario, just north of Toronto. We've never done an episode in multiple parts before, but this story is different. We began our interviews with Corey before the pandemic, but when everything shut down, we had to as well. Often in journalism, when you put a story on hold, it just kind of fizzles. You miss the moment. Someone else reports the story, or it's just not relevant anymore. But that didn't happen with Corey. When we first set out to share his story, we thought we would simply go spearfishing and then go back to his dad, Kenton's house, to make fish cakes with the two of them. But Corey's dad died during the pandemic. So this second episode, it's about reconnecting. And most importantly, recovery. I've been thinking about the word recovery a lot lately. But it's not about recovery from something like healing or getting better or any kind of getting back to normal. It's about the recovery of something, like finding something, something precious that was almost lost. And for Corey, losing his dad meant learning things he wasn't expecting. Hi, I'm Sarah Martin, and this is Home Cooked, a podcast about cherished family recipes and why they get passed on. In part one of Corey's story, we talked about how the fish cake recipe was almost lost. Lost because the Canadian government tried to stamp out Anishinaabeg traditions, making access to the very ingredients needed to make this recipe illegal. Lost because Corey's dad, the man we were supposed to learn the recipe from, died during the pandemic. But Corey Snake was never going to let this recipe go. And after he lost his dad, he did what he's done his whole life. He started looking to the past. He started digging. And that curiosity and his courage to face difficult things helped him find things that had been right here in Rama First Nation the whole time. You've done drywall and everything? You've done a ton.
Yeah, I put in some new windows. Like, there wasn't a window there, I put a window in. And there wasn't a window in his room, I put a window in.
This is so nice.
Did all the flooring. But yeah, so it's coming, everything's coming along. But it's still weird, not like every time I pull in, I still think I'm gonna see him.
Yeah.
You know?
Corey is taking me around his dad's house.
So when I was taking things down off the wall in his garage, I would find like messages hidden behind the pictures and different things I would move. So there'd be writing. I think I actually have one of the signs here somewhere. But he would leave notes of who to leave it to and who to pass it on to. And it'd be direct, like, Corey, after I die, make sure this part of my estate goes to this person and this person.
I can't imagine.
He's the executor of his dad's estate.
Because it was strange because I was working so much on the house. Like, it's a good kind of distraction from everything, even like the loss of him. And then I came in here toiling around. I was like, okay, I'm going to clean the walls off today of all the shelving and open it up. And then I was like, the first thing I pulled down, I was like, you got to be kidding me. And then I started pulling another. I'm like, so then I had to call people and be like, so my dad left you this thing. I can bring it over to you. And there, and then we'd end up having, like, sitting down and chatting about him for, like, a couple hours.
So
style.
Yeah, it looks gorgeous. Mm.
But I still have to finish it. I still have to seal it and like actually drill it in, like put it into the wall. And yeah, there's still some touch-ups I have to do here, but
this is... Well, this place looks like completely different.
Yeah.
It's just weird because obviously, whatever, when we started that story, I didn't think, A, that there would be a pandemic. I didn't think... I didn't think your dad would pass on a recipe that we wouldn't, you know, be here to cook with him.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. But,
yeah, his fish cakes were legendary. Yeah.
We're going to make them. We're going to make them at some point.
Okay, good. Okay. But yeah, that's kind of the, yeah, so this is basically all done. Just a little bit of things here and there. And that's hoping it'd be nice.
I only got to meet Corey's dad, Kenton, once. We met at this same house 4 years ago when he was alive. Here's some of that tape from 2019.
And I'm just going to make sure that's getting in. There you go. Okay. All right. So can you introduce us to your father?
Sure. So this is my father, Kenton Snake. He is born and raised here in Rama. And... I don't even know how old you are now. Born in 53? 65. Yeah.
65
years old.
Yeah. Okay, we're in my garage. My name's Kenton Snake.
Kenton was working in his garage that day. Yeah. It was early afternoon on a Saturday, and Corey's dad was okay with us turning on the microphone.
One thing that sticks out to me is his fish cakes. I love his fish cakes. I've only had them very few times, but they're delicious, and I could eat them by the dozen. And I, to this day, I still don't know how to make them. I ask him, and he tells me, but I never write it down. Yeah.
You want to know how to make it?
Kenton told us his fish cake recipe that day. I got it on tape. The ingredients, the cooking method. Our mouths were watering by the time he finished. We were lucky. We thought we would come back again later to interview him, but we'd never get that chance. Now, sitting here with Corey in his dad's empty house, it's hard to process just how much has happened during the past few years.
Yeah, his wild grapes took over. They're actually all, right now, like, good along the back fence. Nice. I was eating them earlier.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, he
used dad. Out of them. Father.
Dad.
The recipe we're trying to cook, the fish cakes, normally it would have just been passed on from father to son in the family kitchen. But Corey didn't grow up with his dad. He only got to know him when he was older.
So he left when I was 5. So him and my mother separated and divorced. And then I started having a relationship with him again when I was around 14 years old. He was always around, but I didn't associate with him. Like, I didn't talk to him or anything. Like, I'd see him biking down the road, and he'd just, like, nod at me or whatever, and I'd just, like, nod at him. But that was it.
We didn't get to talk with Kenton Snake for very long that day 4 years ago, but he did share some of his story with us.
Well, I was born in Aurelia at the hospital, but yeah, I've lived here most of my life.
He grew up in an era where people still lived off the land. Like, he grew up in Rama when literally our community survived off the lake. Like, and there's still Indian agents in the community. The Indian Act was in full force. Like, it was a whole different reality that I don't even know. So he grew up in that transition where all those laws and all that transition started happening. Like, the Indian agents finally were gone, and then we started getting a little bit of rights back culturally. So he was a part of that shift.
This is my little spot. I got about a half an acre here, you know. That's all I got. But that's good enough, I guess.
Corey had to check his watch the day we dropped in on his dad. He had to make sure it was an okay time to visit. To be sure his dad would be okay when we arrived, because often he wasn't.
He always struggled with addictions. When he was sober, he was very intelligent, very smart, but that only was for a few hours of every day.
I asked Corey when things with him and his dad started to change.
It changed because my stepfather at the time, he ended up leaving. He was like my dad that I kind of recognized growing up. So my sister had always kept a relationship with my dad, and she would urge me to go like talk to him. But the one time I did, I got like terrified. I think I was like 12 years old, and he was living in a trailer down by the lake. And my sister was like, "Come, just come see dad, come see dad." And I was like, "Fine." So I was nervous. I went down there, and then he was there was like a smoldering fire, and then he was living in like a kind of like a silver trailer, like in a small Airstream, and the radio's going. And then my sister called from, was like, dad. And then the door flew open, and there was a crow sitting in a tree cawing, black crow. And he stepped out and he looked at us. He's just in a robe. It was, had to be like 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. or something. And he looked at me really close, and he had sunglasses on already, even though it was like morning, and he just woke up. He like lifted him. He's like, "Yeah, I guess you're my boy," like making like a joke. And he's like, "What's going on, son?" And he's like, "Well, wait a minute." And he went inside, and he came out with a shotgun. And I was like, "What's happening?" Because I was like a little kid. And then he's like, "Caw, caw this motherfucker." And he's like, "Boom!" And he blew the crow, like blew it to pieces. And he's like, "Sorry about that." He's like, "That crow kept me up all night." And then he like put the shotgun away, and I was just like ran. I was like took off running. And then I was like, fuck this. I was like, ah. The first time I actually sat with him after that, I came here with Matt. He was here drinking with a couple of his friends, and I guess through my sister, I told her that I wanted to see him, and she said, "Well, it's good to go up there now." And me and Matt came here, and we sat with him for like 2 hours, had a beer with him. I think we're like 14. And sat with him and just shot the shit for a bit. And then I slowly started coming around more and more. And that was that. Yeah.
The path back to finding his dad came from his sister and his friend Matt. Matt Douglas was Corey's best friend growing up.
We became best friends at grade one. Inseparable. So we grew up together. I grew up in kind of a crazy home. My stability was actually Matt's house. Like, we're over at each other's house every other day. Like, I'd be at his house or he'd be at my house or vice versa forever, for years, until we went to like high school basically. But his house was like the model of like a stable home. Like, he would even get ostracized for it because like he was one of the only kids in Ram that had both parents. And he was one of the only kids in Ram where both parents had money, like a job, just a normal job.
My name is Mark. My Indian name is Badonkwit, which means cloud approaching. I'm from Minjikining, Rama. I'm of the Loon clan, Hmong Dodim, Minjikining and Donjaba. That was part of how I would introduce myself. And it's important that we tell people our name, and that our clan and the community that we come from.
Do you remember Mark Douglas from the first part of Corey's story? He's an elder and knowledge keeper here in Rama First Nation. He's also Matt's dad. And he was kind of a father figure to Corey.
It's a deep relationship. And when I went to seek my spirit name, I took an offering to Badonkwit, which is Mark's spirit name, and asked him to give me my name because he knew me better than anybody.
When I dreamed his name, it was a harvesting site. We call it Sucker Creek, but he was further back in the watershed, further up. But I could hear him yelling, "They're over here!" And I could hear his voice clearly. And then it became all this life at the creek, all these eyes and different movements, senses of things. I saw turtles and frogs and fish and bird life and fox come and looked at me. So choosing his name was really difficult because there was so much activity going on. That's 10 things. That's 10 more things. It's like you're in the grocery store and you want it all, but you can only have one. Which one is it? And then I realized I was watching everything from a particular vantage point. So I began looking to see where I was in that awesomeness of all this wildlife. And then realized I was a predator, a bird, sitting on a bare branch limb, and I'm watching all this activity going on. And it took a while to step away and turn around and look at myself to see what I was.
My name is Gnu in our language, which means golden eagle. My family comes from the Sturgeon clan, and I am a member of Rama First Nation.
I think when growing up, I always had chaotic people in my life from male figure perspective. So he being here, he was always a foundation. I got to see what it was like to have an effective father through my friends and hear what he would have to say to them. And then I could be like, yeah, that is the right way to be. So there was always that positive influence, which was good.
Even though Corey's dad wasn't around much until his teens, Mark was. And he was an example for Corey. Mark was holding on to the stories from his ancestors and trying to tell anyone who would hear. Stories like how people had gathered for a millennia at the 5,000-year-old Minjikining fish weir site right here in Lake Kuchiching. Mark showed Corey what was almost lost in this community and why it was so important to relearn and never forget.
I'm like the first one in my family that wasn't taken away. Like my generation, my siblings, all of our parents and aunts and uncles, grandparents were all taken away.
Corey's dad, Kenton, was taken away from Rama as a child.
I lived in Toronto for a year. I lived in Kitchener for probably six. Lived in Lindsay when I was going to college down there at Sanford Fleming for a year and a half. Dropped out. And, I've lived here, yeah.
He lived in Kitchener, Ontario because he was taken away by the government, but he doesn't say that. He just says he went to school. And even going to school in the community, that was an Indian day school where it was the same as a residential school.
Out of his age group in our community, there were only four people that were not taken away out of the whole community. So you have to imagine this whole community being childless and just adults and parents here being like, where's all of our kids? Like, I could never fathom.
My parents stopped speaking to us in Indian at home when we started going. I know that for sure. I even asked my mother. She thought it was a better idea that I don't speak that language. So then over the years, I've forgotten it, you know, because I never used it. But he knows more than I do. It's been so long since I used it that I forgot, you know. Not everything. Never forget everything.
From the year like 2004 to now, we went from 40 speakers to probably 10. So it's a big thing. But the generation gap is directly because of assimilation processes. So the youngest speaker that I know of next to me is in their 60s, maybe 62, 64 years old. And then there's a gap. So there's a gap even with his generation because there's very few people that age that speak because they weren't taken away.
That gap meant Corey's grandparents lived in a community without kids, and Corey's generation lived in a community without parents.
So even though my grandmother was a speaker, she still wouldn't speak to any of her children because it was also illegal to speak. There was a number of laws. It was legal to speak Ojibwe. There was the conjugation law. If there are three or more Native people in a group, you could be thrown in jail for conjugating. If you're caught off reserve past 6 p.m., like, they had us literally at every which way. And then we had Indian agents embedded in our community that ensured that we didn't speak within our communities. So everything was a form of control. So a lot of people don't know, like a lot of people are starting to learn about residential school and 60 scoop and mainstream type of things, I call them. But there's all these little micro things in place that were other forms of control that were there to support the big things going on like residential school and 60 scoop.
Corey is one of only 10 people in his community who speak Ojibwe.
Our understandings of the world is embedded in our language, how we perceive everything to be. Even from the way we describe fish to all living things, when we speak about it, they're specific. We're describing typically our spiritual connection to that.
the older word is Osawe, but it's for perch, but it means how it has a yellow rounded belly. So if you ever catch a perch, you'll get its belly. It's all rounded and yellow. So it describes exactly how that fish is seen. And any fish with the sound nameh in it, like nameh for a sturgeon, nameh goes for a trout, or maje nameh goes for a salmon, it all means that they're deep dwelling fish. So it tells exactly where you can find them. So even our geography, our understandings are just embedded throughout.
His grandmother did her best to teach him against all odds, whereas my parents didn't think it was important. Get a good education, you'll get a good job, and life will be hunky-dory. Forget all that old Indian stuff.
Luckily, Mark Douglas didn't forget all that old stuff. And he was around a lot when Corey was a kid to make sure he didn't either. Mark spent most of his life fighting to keep stories from his community alive.
In our First Nations community, there are faith keepers. They're the ones who hold ceremonies and the songs. And there are language keepers. They're the ones who hold the language, and we have very few of them left. And there are the story keepers, like myself and my brother. And we're just given stories or heard stories or encouraged to be storytellers.
That's Mark's sister, Sherry Lawson. She, like Mark, has spent her life collecting, cultivating, cherishing, and telling her ancestors' stories. Home Cooked is a show about family recipes and why they get passed on. In a recipe, between the lines of the ingredients and the cooking instructions, there's always a story. A story about a family, where they come from, how they define themselves, and how they break bread together. To get to Kenton's fish cakes, we have to look at how it was almost lost. Because ways of life were almost destroyed, Indigenous knowledge was suppressed. Because access to the land and ingredients was limited. Because kids didn't grow up with their parents. But despite all the racist, systemic factors that were working against Corey Snake and his family, this recipe and the rich history it contains within it did survive. After the break, we're going underwater. This is where we normally host an ad from our sponsor, Maple Leaf Foods. And we'd talk about something like how Maple Leaf Foods is the world's first major carbon-neutral food company, or how they're Canada's largest provider of poultry raised without antibiotics. But we're not going to do that. Home Cooked is about food and family. And today in Canada, more and more families are struggling to access food. So today, we're going to use this ad spot to talk to Sarah Stern instead.
My name is Sarah Stern, and I'm the Executive Director of the Maple Leaf Center for Food Security. So over the past year, we've seen a 20% increase in food insecurity. It's the biggest jump in food insecurity since I started working in this space. And when you think about it, it now means that one in four children lives in a house that can't afford the food that it needs.
Sarah, tell me if you can, what does being food insecure in Canada look like?
You know, it's an interesting thing when you think about who is food insecure. We know that only about 20% of people in Canada who are food insecure are accessing emergency or charitable food relief. So you could be talking to people who are food insecure every day without knowing it. It could be your cubicle mate. It could be the teacher at your child's school. It's really hard to know.
And what do you say when people ask what they can do?
I think for the center, the most important thing is to get policymakers to care about this issue. And policymakers care when their constituents care. So we try to reach people, tell them about the issue and say, you know, if this is something that's resonating with you, share the message. If this is something you really care about, contact your elected official. And yeah, you know what? If you are able to make a donation that's going to support people in those communities, support your local food charity, but we'd encourage you to do that and also contact your elected official and tell them that this is important to you.
Thanks, Sarah. Now back to the show.
Anytime in my life, especially when I was a teenager, when I struggled with things,
like depression and so on and so forth, I always ended up on the water. It wasn't like a conscious thing. It was like any time I was battling something, I'd end up out in my canoe or just drifting and paddling or down at a beach and just sitting beside the water. And I didn't understand why I would do that or the importance of it. And then when I told an elder that, they're like, oh, you're connected, and it's the spirit of the water that's drawing you to the healing.
We are back out on Lake Kuchiching in Corey's dad's boat.
So all these little circles in the sand, see those clear sand circles?
Yeah.
Those are all spawn beds. Those are fish where their eggs are laid. So we are on Lake Kuchiching. That comes from the word Guojin Jiaojing, which means a force comes in from the outside, describing how a narrows functions.
So Rama traditionally was where our people would come, like Minjikining, where our community used to be before we were a reserve, and when settlers started coming up, where it was basically downtown Orillia all the way to the narrows was that whole lakeshore, well, that whole front. So Minjikining, referencing the fish fence, it literally means you're at the fences. And when I would go speak Ojibwe to people up north, when I'd say where I was from, they'd use an old term to describe me, like that's not used anymore, that's used in like my grandparents' age, and they'd call me a fence man, because that's what they'd referenced people long ago as from Rama. They'd call me Majiknini.
The fence man. When I first heard about the 5,000-year-old site right here at the bottom of Lake Kuchiching, I was astonished.
People would have taken cedar posts. They would have harvested cedar trees, stripped the bark off, and they sink them into the ground, and they form basically a pathway that fish have to follow, and they get lost and tangled in a trap, essentially, and they can't find their way out. Our people would come along those weir system and spearfish them. So it forms a live trap, essentially. It's a good way to basically coax fish into one area to make harvesting efficient.
The fish fence. The old stakes deep in the mud of this lake. It's one of the oldest and best preserved indigenous fish weir sites in North America.
Hardly anybody in my village knew that story. I guess we were told to forget about all that old stuff.
When you think of the name of our lake, Guojin Jiaojing, like a force comes in, squeezes through from the outside. If you notice the current here, that's the flow coming in from Lake Simcoe, right through here. So that's why we called, that's how our people describe physically how a narrows works in our language. Like it describes the physicality of how it operates. So it shows our worldview and how things are perceived. So this would have just pushed the fish right through the whole weir system.
A force comes in from outside.
He said that wooden stakes had been driven into the mucky bottom in such a way that it looked like a fence, and it was able to trap the fish. And people would come mid-March and stay there the rest of March and April and 1 or 2 weeks into May, and then they'd head out to other places. But during that time, they would be harvesting the fish life that was coming through. The fish go from the deeper lake, Simcoe, up into this lake, Kuchiching, to spawn. And many, many fish and different species all come through at different times. He talked about 400 families all showing up there and working together. A camp would form. Young people would meet other young people, and, you know, love would happen, and marriages eventually, and everybody left and took fish home with them.
Everybody took fish home.
He said it was like somebody brought a warm blanket and wrapped, put it around your shoulders. It was like getting a warm hug. And he said that's what that place was. It was so special. And there was so much kindness oozing out of the water, out of that little place. That's why people all would come there. We were lucky other communities from afar knew some of our story, and they came here to tell us our story, that what they had heard when they were young. And we were so lucky, because if we didn't have them to come and remind us of who we were and what we were carrying and the story of the background, it would have been lost. We were so lucky.
And it's a very important area for history of not only our nation, but so many other nations as well that were here at one time. So it's embedded in multiple histories and multiple centuries.
So it's like a gift that the stories got through about the fish fence circle.
But it was almost lost.
We could host nations and host people here and always have adequate food.
Adequate food. For a century, the people of Rama First Nation were ordered to forget. Forget their language, their culture. Forget their traditional harvesting and hunting methods. Forget to live off the land, their recipes. Take on the new ways. Diets suffered, people suffered, families suffered.
But there was a time my council couldn't be bothered.
What made you care at that time? When no one else was caring, how did you keep caring?
Listening to Renson, I guess. Just hearing his voice and knowing that it was important. It just took a while for others to wake up.
This recipe survived because of a handful of people. The Weirs have been here for thousands and thousands of years. About an hour and a half north of Toronto, just under the surface of the water in the narrows that join Lake Simcoe and Lake Couchiching. They may be obscured, but just because you can't see them doesn't mean they don't exist. And just because it's hard to hear doesn't mean the story isn't being told.
We grew up on it, like it's embedded in our name of who we are and our identity. We believe that when we move into an area, we become stewards of it. That's just our understanding of everything. So we are stewards of this fish fence, and I grew up on stories of it.
When you're in the water like this, on this lake that you know so well, and that sight, how does that sight make you feel? Or if you had to describe the feeling of it?
I think just pride. Feeling pride, like knowing that, like it's evidence that our people have been here for thousands of years in this area, not just our people but other people. So it's obvious, like, and it's grown to be such a significant place, and it's something that can't be taken away. Like when you imprint your identity into the landscape, you can't erase it. And that's a big part of even us naming our places in our language. You can't take it away. And having things like the Weirs in certain geographic locations, it shows the importance of how, you know, how important the land was to our people.
Home Cooked is about family recipes. And this episode has been different because, as you've probably noticed, we haven't got to the cooking part yet. For a recipe like this to be passed on, you need to cook together. You need to share language. You need access to common ingredients. And you need family. And for Corey and generations of Indigenous people, colonization and systemic racism that still exist today got in the way of all those things. But Corey and his family persevered, and the recipe survived. I hope you'll join us for the final part of Corey's story. In the next episode, we'll go to Kenton Snake's house to make his fish cakes. And even though he's not there anymore, we'll make them with him. If you want to make Corey's dad's fish cakes, head over to homecookedpodcast.com to learn how. You'll also see images by portrait photographer Rita Leisner. This episode of Home Cooked was produced by Lisa Gabriel, Katie McGuire, Vanessa Connolly, Sean Liliani, Nicole Edwards, and me. Cameron McIver does sound design. Sean Liliani and Stefan Banjevich composed original music for this episode. Artist Charlotte Fisick created our downloadable recipe cards. Candace Craig does graphic design and website. Composers Dan Misha Goldman and Sean Brody wrote our theme music. Sean Liliani is video producer. And I'm so grateful to Corey Snake for sharing his story. Thanks for listening.